The Jubilee Fund believes that everyone has a role in poverty reduction in Manitoba. As individuals, in order to act, we need to know what is going on so we can find our place in reducing poverty. Our speaker series, which includes community-based solutions, is designed to inform community members of challenges poverty creates in our province, introduce hope into the conversation, along with the knowledge of the opportunities for individuals to act to reduce poverty in the community. We are also very aware that many people dedicate their lives to organizations that work tirelessly to reduce poverty, and this series is intended to profile and honor their hard work. Tonight, our program is in three parts. We will hear a presentation from Molly McCracken from CCPA and Make Poverty History, who will be presenting statistics around mental health and poverty. Molly's presentation will be followed by Kate Gale, a community member with lived mental health experience. Kate's presentation will be followed by Dr. Jason Ettinger, a psychologist for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Institute, which is a project of Jubilee Funds. We will attempt to answer all questions entered into the chat bar throughout presentations at the end. Without further delay, it's my pleasure to introduce Molly McCracken, Executive Director of CCPAMB. Molly?
Hello, can everybody hear me okay? Sounds good? Okay, sounds good. Well, thank you so much to the Jubilee Fund and Monica for inviting me to speak tonight. I have a tremendous amount of respect for the Jubilee Fund, what an important organization in our community to support those struggling with poverty and the organizations that support them to get a leg up in our world. And the COVID-19 pandemic has laid bare the differences even more starkly between those who have and those who have not. Even more so between those who have sick leave and those who don't have any sick leave, for those who have some savings and don't have any savings. And we know from statistics about the economic impact of COVID that it's being felt across all sectors of our economy, but particularly low-income people, precarious workers are being laid off first, part-time workers are being laid off first, and women in particular are feeling the brunts of these impacts. And so if you're in that boat, my heart goes out to you. I hope that you're able to get support and reach out for support during this difficult time. We are pleased to see the federal government is really stepping up. Of course, we need much more. And all of this has huge impacts. It's a health crisis, it's an economic crisis, and mental health is really important at this time, of course, for all of us, particularly those who are most impacted, I would say. And so we need organizations like the Jubilee Fund now more than ever, and also in our recovery. At where I work, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, we're talking about this is the emergency period. We're doing emergency response right now. And then once things open up a bit, we'll enter into a recovery phase, and we're going to need to help our most vulnerable and everybody impacted by COVID in this recovery phase until we get back to hopefully a more just society than when we entered this pandemic. And so the topic of mental health is particularly poignant during COVID for reasons I think we're all experiencing right now. I feel a bit of cabin fever. I had to leave my house for the first time in a long time, actually, and I felt a little bit anxious. I already have moderate anxiety that I deal with. And so, I think we should just take a big collective breath in and out and know that we will get through this. And if you need help, please reach out for help. Be easy on ourselves and take care of ourselves and each other as much as possible. I've been counting my blessings. I'm appreciative of the warmer weather, and I know that we can get through this. So I'm going to talk about the connections between public policy and mental health. And I am a generalist, I'm a researcher, so I'm going to talk about research our office has done on this issue, and I look forward to the other panelists' presentations as well. Mm-hmm. Just a note on who we are here at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. We're a non-profit, non-partisan, charitable research institute, and we've been in Manitoba since 1997, and we do appreciate the support of the Jubilee Fund in our work. I'm also a member of Make Poverty History Manitoba, which is a big tent coalition that does work to advocate for the end of poverty here through strong progressive public policy. And so I'm speaking wearing those two hats. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of public policy and mental health care, some work that we've done in the community here, some things that are currently happening with COVID that I think are particularly important, and then what broadly practitioners and public policy progressives are asking for from our governments in terms of mental health policy support. So, you know, some of you are experts in this area, and you will remember that there's been a big journey in terms of mental health care. And I'll go back to the 60s and 70s, where we saw mental health care move from institutional care to community care, which was progress. And we moved to outpatient clinics and case management services that were supposed to help people improve coping skills, live successfully in the community. And these are all really important goals. However, experts argue that the community-based services, that move was never adequately funded properly, and to this day is not funded properly. And I'm going to talk about what that would look like if it was funded properly. On top of this, we've had, you know, in the 90s, 2000s, and still to this day, the rise of neoliberalism, of individualism, of the capitalist economy taking hold without the caring and social welfare supports behind that. And so we've had a divestment in supports for people, so stagnant social assistance rates, welfare rates, not enough public or social housing, not enough options for recreation, transportation. And these are underlying root causes that lead somebody who's got a mental health condition or others might exacerbate their mental health. And so that's work that our office does. And so this crisis, we talk about addictions as part of mental health, is something that we see every day as people struggle to survive in our cities and communities, and we see the visible effects of homelessness. And of course, it also lives behind closed doors in our communities as well. So every year, our office does the State of the Inner City Report, which is a community-based research where we meet with community groups, you know, women's centers, youth serving groups, community-based walk-in, drop-in centers, and we ask them, what are the issues on your mind? What's needed? And we try and shine a light on what's happening to hold up successes and then also challenges, and then say, these are the public policy responses that would help deal with these. And so the issue of meth was becoming more and more important to people as people saw the visible impacts of meth. And people push back on the idea that it was a particular meth crisis. They say the crisis is poverty, social exclusion, colonization, and that it's being manifested most recently through increased visible use of meth in our community. So we did this report. I'll hold it up. I can do a show and tell. This is the State of the Inner City Report 2015. It's called The Forest for the Trees, Reducing Mental Health and Drug Harms in Winnipeg's Inner City. And so it documents the impacts of meth use as experienced by community-based residents and organizations and what must be done. And I want to thank particularly the Jubilee Fund for supporting this year's report. We looked at the policy frameworks. You know, the province has jurisdiction for healthcare, for mental health care, and there was certainly a lot in the papers this last fall about what can and should be done. And our research found that, you know, you might have heard of the Virgo report, which is an extensive report with recommendations, and also the Illicit Drug Task Force report, were being implemented in a very ad hoc way. There was no clear strategy on how government was moving forward with all of the recommendations there. And also this heightened rhetoric of a meth crisis, community groups were saying, was intensifying a law, order, and security response. And of course, safety is very, very important. We need people to be safe. But there's a lot in the evidence about the need for a public health approach and a harm reduction approach, and also addressing the conditions of what people call problematic substance use. And there was not enough attention to those issues. And when we've seen that in other countries, that they've gotten more at the root causes of the social conditions, that then has a ripple effect to address and also improve safety for everyday citizens, and also those most affected, those who are vulnerable and who might be criminalized or using drugs. And so community-based group said people are arriving at their doors in states of emergencies, but they had very few resources and they were also strapped to be able to provide help to people who were in a crisis related to meth. So the research finds very high rates of income inequality. We have double the rate of poverty in the inner city of Winnipeg, for example, than the rest of Winnipeg. Although in suburban Winnipeg, we do have pockets of poverty as well. Lower educational outcomes, insecure housing, high child apprehension rates in the welfare system, and the ongoing impacts of colonization and intergenerational trauma led people to have few protective factors, few resources to deal. And this creates an environment where people turn to drugs to cope. And so this is very harmful, and we need to move upstream from these terrible downstream effects and work with people with lived experience of drugs in order to address these root causes. And so the current government responses are not doing enough to address the structural harms which create the systems of mental health and drug use and how these are experienced by people. And the presentation of meth is a symptom of a much bigger social crisis and a failure by government to address the basic needs of people who experience the highest level of marginalization. And so the report says we have to come to this with compassion rather than fear and punishment, and recommends a clear strategy to implement the government's own recommendations based on principles of public health and harm reduction. So harm reduction means meeting people where they're at, working with people with lived experience, and providing support so that we're not being as judgmental about the drugs, and then we can also support them to improve their own circumstances. And so community-based groups like the ones that the Jubilee Foundation help are very important connectors. They develop a sense of trust with their participants and create hope, meaning, and belonging and purpose. And so they are very important to ladder people into supports, but they must be properly funded and supported. And also community-based groups, drop-in centers, and everyone else can't be expected to meet people's basic needs. That's the role of the social welfare state. That's the role of government, of Canada, of Manitoba, and the city of Winnipeg, of course. And so now I'll turn, you know, we did that report, we launched it back in December, we're following the recommendations, and then I think all of us were just hit. I remember the beginning of March where I was hearing more and more about COVID, and then it just hit Manitoba, and everything's been happening very quickly. And I really send a shout out to the community-based groups. They've done an amazing job to turn their operations around. People are doing takeaway bag lunches, activity kits for children because of the schools being shut down. Basic needs supplies are being delivered to participant houses. And just the speed of the change that community groups have been adapting to the new circumstances is quite amazing. But we still have inadequate welfare rates. Employment and income assistance doesn't provide an extra budget for a phone or internet. So there's a huge digital divide now with kids who have internet at home and kids don't have internet at home. And most people on EIA don't get any extra money for a cell phone or a phone, relying a lot on public phones that were in drop-in centers, but those are now all closed. So people can't even call health links in an emergency. So low EIA rates are really a public health problem, and we're seeing that particularly now during the COVID crisis. And so this is why Make Poverty History Manitoba is calling on the province to provide an emergency support benefit for those on social assistance of $300 a month, following the lead of what British Columbia did. They did this, and also for seniors on low incomes as well. So we have a petition at www.nopoverty.ca under news. And if you, I can put it in the chat after, but if you take a moment to look at that and sign it, and also email, call the premier, your MLA, because Manitoba is the only province that has not given any income supports during COVID. Every other province has done something for people who've lost work or people on assistance. And it is quite stark that Manitoba hasn't done anything. So here at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, we are a research, think, and do tank. So we are doing everything we can for rapid response. That means responding to media, commenting, and showing the damaging impacts of austerity that this province is continuing to cut taxes and cut services during a crisis. And two economists associated with us just released something I can also share with you yesterday. They crunched the numbers and show that the cuts will actually cost Manitoba more money down the road, and that we can afford through debt financing to pay for income supports, because the government is important to help an economy float through a crisis like this. The government is different than a business, for example. The government, as we've learned through the Great Depression, has a role to stimulate and keep the economy going. And our provincial government needs to learn the lesson of standard economic theory and not cut, especially during a crisis. Instead, we're seeing the shock doctrine here. This is a book by Naomi Klein written in 2007 about increased accelerated privatization during a crisis. And one example related to mental health is, out of the blue, the province announces $4.5 million for Murnau Chapelle, which is a private corporation, to provide online cognitive behavioral therapy supports to people. And an op-ed was quickly in the Winnipeg Free Press by psychologist Drek Dauda and University of Manitoba Ethics Institute Director Neil MacArthur, and asked, why didn't the province talk to the local mental health community and instead deliver these supports through local health providers here? We have some amazing providers here, instead of turning to this private corporation out of province. You know, our local mental health sector is already underfunded. And in Manitoba, mental health care is about 5% of our health care budget. And international and national research say it should be about 9% of our health care budget. And so that's why Make Poverty History Manitoba and national groups, along with the Canadian Mental Health Association, talk about doubling mental health care expenditures. And we need federal help, but we also need the province to step up. And we need a priority to community mental health services. So mental health care is part of a continuum. We all need access to this. You know, at some point in your life, you may, or somebody in your family, I'm sure we all know somebody who has needed this help. In particular, my mother and my best friend, you know, have dealt with mental health challenges in their lives. And we know that people who are living in poverty have even fewer options. They don't have privately funded medical insurance, for example, which can speed access to treatments provided by psychologists. People who live in poverty are more likely to encounter discrimination if they're trying to get help. And studies show they have fewer referrals to specialists or fewer treatment options than people with more money. And we need more of these supports in the community. And currently, without these supports as people need them, then it gets to an acute crisis situation for someone, and then they use our more expensive healthcare services, which we really need to move that up and provide more preventative supports to people. And that people recommend should be done through community mental health organizations to deliver education, prevention, and early intervention to stem the tide of services needed in the acute side. And particularly here in Manitoba, you know, I should have recognized off the top that I'm here on Treaty 1 territory, the homeland of the Métis Nation, and our Indigenous brothers and sisters and relatives are disproportionately affected by poverty and, of course, the terrible impacts of colonization and intergenerational trauma. So we need investments in programs and services to service this population and prioritize service to this population. And this can be done by working with Indigenous-led organizations and with the First Nations, Métis, Inuit governments, and increasing the number of Indigenous people who work in healthcare and providing culturally centered supports. So just to conclude, right now, Manitoba spends the most on any department is in health. We spend $6 billion on health, but we spend about $300 million of that on mental health care. And we're saying we need to double that to really meet the need. And so that just puts into context, I think, some of the struggles that people see on the ground, that we're really not supporting people enough. And we need to support people more through better mental health. healthcare, through social assistance and other social determinants of health supports, as well as the mental health care that people are receiving. So that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer questions when we get to that point. Thank you so much.
There we go. Thanks, Molly. If anyone has questions for Molly, you can send them using the chat bar and we will get to them at the end of the presentations. Our next presenter is Kate Gale. Kate will be sharing about her lived experience with mental health. Hi, Kate. Kate?
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, so hello, I'm Kate Gale. I am here to share my poverty and mental health journey with you. And I'd like to start by saying thank you to the Jubilee Fund and all of you listening to my story. A special thanks to Jason Ettinger, who is my CBTI therapist, and then my mom, who has always been the constant light in my life. If you have any questions, like she said, just leave them in the chat box and I'll answer them as I can. Okay, so I believe poverty puts people in situations that cause them to make choices that normally they would not have to make. I found myself choosing whatever path would help me get by in the moment instead of the safest or smartest choices. I chose to have toxic people in my life because they were a sort of security blanket that I believed kept me from hitting rock bottom, when in all honesty, they kept dragging me closer and closer to that dark, lonely hole. I grew up in a normal family unit with a mom, a dad, and a little brother. We were never the family with much, but my parents worked very hard and we got by. We ended up moving often, which meant a lot of new schools. We had hand-me-down clothings, the regular peanut butter sandwiches, and the same school supplies each year. We were happy. That put a target on us as the poor, weird kids, which turned us into the objects of bullying. I can't remember a school year where my brother and I weren't bullied. It was just normal for us to be treated as the dirt as by the other kids. Throughout school, I received every type of bullying you can think of and then some. The amount of times a knife was pulled on me at school would actually scare you. What I learned most during those years was how to appear strong and hide my real feelings of vulnerability. Despite being the most hated person at school, I was an avid learner. Whatever topic I had interest in, I researched it in every way possible. After a lot of time spent researching statistics, how-tos, to-do versus not-to-dos, I attempted suicide. Once at 14 in the spring, I was unsuccessful. I took that as a sign to keep trying to go about my life, being strong and not letting the bullies get to me. I spent the summer enjoying myself. I attempted a second time in the fall, a few months after school had started back up. Being constantly told negative things about yourself, no matter the amount of truth to them, you eventually start to believe them. I believed all the bad things in my life were my fault. I believed everything the bully said about me, being ugly, stupid, weird, a whore. I thought all of that was true. Those thoughts led me to assume that all bad things happening to my family were also my fault. The bad things that happened to my friends, my fault. Believing your existence is what causes the people you love most, all of their pain, is a lot for a teen to take on. Even though it wasn't true, I believed if I could disappear, all my loved ones' problems would go away too. The problem with being verbally and emotionally abused is how you search for ways to feel positive emotions. I didn't have friends. My cousins were too young or too old. And my parents were always working. I thought online friends would be the best route for me. They made me feel beautiful and understood. Eventually, they convinced me to webcam with them. The things they had me doing for them to give them some sort of positive praise was alarming. As an adult, I now know this is referred to as grooming. If you don't know what grooming is, it's defined as the action by a pedophile of preparing a child for a meeting, especially via an internet chat room, with the intention of committing a sexual offense. Lots of my online friends wanted to meet, but I was way too shy to ever go that far, with hope I'd find some friends at a new job. I worked a few of those regular teen jobs before I landed my first job in a high volume kitchen. What I learned working in that kitchen first, women were not welcome because we were too emotional. And second, I was a people pleaser. People pleaser is defined as a person who has an emotional need to please others, often at the expense of his or her own needs or desires. Something I learned after working in kitchens was how much alcohol, drugs, and partying actually went on. You could go to work drunk or high, or even do it on shift. The only thing that mattered was making the restaurant's money. I was harassed, abused, hazed, bullied, all while working in kitchens, and nothing was ever done to help me. I was chased out of quite a few of my jobs because I never gave in to my coworkers' or bosses' sexual advances. In my search to find where I belonged, I lived with my extended family, who showed me that even if you're related, they can take advantage of you and treat you with remarkable cruelty. While living with my cousin, who was my best friend since birth, she convinced me to start online dating. Having her involved in my life made me feel worth something. While my cousin was out partying, I invited a guy I met online over for a movie and dinner. And instead, he ended up raping me. My cousin said I asked for it, and I had no experience, and I trusted her blindly. So I hid those painful emotions away and acted strong again. This started my abusive relationship cycle. I had moved far away from my care, my core family, still believing, oops, my battery on my laptop is dying. One moment. Sorry, guys. I'm not sure why it's not charging. I think I just blew a breaker, so I'm gonna have to move my laptop or it's gonna die.
No worries at all, Kate. We can wait.
Okay, one moment.
As we wait for Kate to sort it out, just a reminder that if you guys have any questions, you can enter them in the chat. This goes for Molly's presentation. I know we received one question in regards to that one, as well as for Kate's presentation and following this Dr. Jason's. So feel free to take the time now to enter any questions you may have.
Okay, I'm charging.
Perfect.
Sorry about that. Okay, so I'm sorry, I'm trying to read my speech without speeding through it with the nerves. Okay, so I had moved far away from my core family, still believing the further away I was, the less problems I caused them. I was still pursuing those positive emotions while ignoring the trauma for months. It was lonely. I wanted to make friends, but had no idea how to do that in a city I moved to without knowing anyone. So back online I went. I swore to myself it was just to find friends and was open about that with all the guys I talked to. One guy I became good friends with, he showed me the city and taught me how to party. I thought I had been drinking too much, that I was blacking out each night. When I went to bed, I later found out that my new friend had been slipping me a date rape drug. He had been assaulting me for a couple months. I felt myself crumbling, another piece of my soul dying. Instead of letting myself break completely, I stuffed those feelings away and focused on being strong again. I was back to being alone, no friends at my current job because I was focused on repaying my parents after losing all of mine and their savings. in an apartment lease my extended family had stuck me with. I had to decide to move back home to Manitoba or find a way to make more money. My boss at the time knew I was in a difficult situation. I was given a promotion, a raise, and some validation. I was finally management in a restaurant. It was all thanks to that boss. He invited me to hang out with the staff and helped me make friends. Soon he and I ended up dating. Early on, I saw all the red flags, but ignored them because he knew exactly how to guilt me into believing the bad things that happened were my fault. Eventually, he had me believing that if I left him, he would die. I knew I caused bad things, but I didn't want to be responsible for a death. I met some new friends outside our work circle who shone a light on his manipulations. I started to question him. He started physically abusing me. He proposed to me after 14 months of us dating, well after the abuse had started. I didn't see it coming. Not once did I ever agree to marrying him, but I knew if I openly said no, I'd probably be the one who died. Over the next 8 months, I had friends outside his circle and one of our mutual friends helping me plot my escape. Getting out of an abusive relationship is extremely hard. However, run, get out, and never stay for any reason because it's never worth your pain. I went into hiding from him. As he was my boss, I lost my job. He took everything I had except my cat, Sterling Archer, who I still have today. I was lucky to find an office job quickly. I still had my own circle of friends and a brand new apartment to myself. My friends took me out dancing where I ran into the date rape guy. I caught a break. My friends brought a nice guy to set me up with who helped me evade him. This was the guy who introduced me to my first taste of gaslighting. Gaslighting is defined as to manipulate someone by psychological means into questioning their own sanity. Instead of questioning him, I turned to alcohol. Over the years, I learned a lot about alcohol. One moment. And how to numb my traumatic memories with it. What I didn't learn was to love myself, accept the beautiful person that I am, and get the help I desperately needed. It took me 5 years of being abused in every way to decide that it was time I moved back home. I went from having an income, my own place, to living with my parents on their couch for 2 years. The first job I got, I started saving money. I tried to make friends online again, but I promised myself I would be more careful, as if that was the problem. I was slipped the date rape drug at a public restaurant, and then the guy brought me back to his house. I made it over a year and a half without having my first mental breakdown. I was lucky I made a few friends through my parents during that time I lived with them. I moved in with some of those friends, left my job due to another breakdown, and didn't get out of bed for a couple weeks. A friend helped me understand that I needed real help. That's when I met my incredibly talented CBTI therapist. Over the next 2 years, I learned how to get past my trauma, love who I was, and get a new job. I thought I was cured in a few short months. Sadly, that job ended with me contemplating a third suicide attempt. I backslid. I sat next to a river in my car every day for weeks, trying to decide how long it would take me to officially disappear and stop feeling all those hidden emotions. I had lost my friends due to a misunderstanding I still don't understand. Work was becoming impossible, and I didn't recognize myself. Fortunately, I knew who to call. CBTI therapy saved my life because it taught me how to continually work through my anxieties, deal with my traumas, and they did it without any judgments. I am currently unemployed due to the virus, as many of us are, but I am working hard on my own book and my self-employment gig as an empowerment coach. It took me 27 years to figure out what I was meant to do, and my experiences are helping others, and that was the best outcome I could have asked for. I am happily in a positive relationship with an extraordinary man and an eccentric stepdaughter. I have learned how to surround myself with a supportive group of friends, but most importantly, I've learned how to love myself first. So as a good friend of mine says, instead of getting worked up about things not working out, follow what the Friends show taught us and yell pivot. Thank you for listening to my story, and I can't wait for you to meet the next speaker.
Thank you, Kate, for your amazing story and your vulnerability and sharing that with us. That was really amazing, so thank you. If you guys have any questions for Kate, again, you can send them in the chat bar and we will get to them at the end of the presentation. So thanks again, Kate. Our final presenter is Dr. Jason Ettinger, psychologist at the CBTI, which is also a project of Jubilee Funds. Dr. Ettinger will be sharing about his experience with mental health and poverty as a psychologist in the field. Dr. Ettinger.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi there.
I wanted to start by saying thank you to Jubilee Fund as well, because while CBTI has been in existence as a nonprofit psychological clinic since about 1999, we decided in about 2015, 2016, we were looking, going, there are no psychology clinics north of HSC. And we were trying to figure out a way to be able to bring psychology north into, as we were talking about, one of the areas where there is less psychology. I think one of the reasons there's less psychology there, the money is in River Heights and Charleswood and the south of Winnipeg. And if you're in a private practice model, it makes sense to go where the money is. So we were doing some research and Jubilee Fund helped us open our current North End office, which is in Riverbend, just north of Cheapegus Trail. And we work to maintain a nonprofit model in which some of our services are fee-for-service and some of our services are pro bono. I think one of the things to pay attention to, when you look at Kate's story that she told us, how many times she restarted. She'd rally and the world would pull the rug out from under her. She'd rally and the world would pull the rug out from under her. And every time she's a little bit weaker and it's a little bit harder to restart. And that kind of explains some of the interaction between poverty and mental health. Mental health doesn't make you, or mental health challenges don't make you poor necessarily, but they make it harder to earn a living. And poverty doesn't make you have mental health challenges, but they add to the stresses and make it an ongoing challenge where they interact with one another. There's this myth that poor people are stupid, that they make these decisions that smart people don't make. And if they would just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and do better, they wouldn't have to drink as much and they wouldn't have to do all these things. But research actually tells us that we don't think the same way when we're stressed and we're poor. When you don't have options, it's harder to think three steps ahead. You only think one step ahead because you're trying to just get through that moment. So in an effort to personalize this, I got permission from two people that I work with to tell a little bit about their stories. The first woman, we're going to call her Maria. She's an early 50s woman. She has three kids. She also lost two children to young death when they were quite little. And she has a long, long trauma history. Now, we were mentioning earlier about the impact of COVID in this scenario. And ironically, that while I picked this story months ago, plays a role here as well. So she has been in and out of employment a million times. She'll get distressed. She'll end up in hospital. She gets discharged. She returns to employment. And there's this kind of revolving cycle of trying to get back into the workplace, struggling with poverty, struggling to afford the medication that she needs in order to maintain her mental health. And then we add something like she turned out, she's not one of our official cases of COVID, but she was down for approximately 2.5 to 3 weeks with a fever, chills, fatigue, everything they tell us to look for with COVID, in a two-bedroom apartment with seven people in it. How do you socially isolate with potentially COVID-19 in a two-bedroom apartment with 7 people in it. And the person who can work is still going to work because they can't afford not to. This is a family where she will not eat for 2 days just to make sure that the kids have food to eat. And I'm telling her to take care of herself. Exercise, eat right, all of these different things. That's way more challenging to do in the context where you have very limited resources. She once discharged herself from health sciences and walked to her appointment with me in Riverbend. That's like a 2-hour, 2.5-hour walk. We don't think about these things when we're trying to manage and understand people's stress. She once backtracked 6 hours trying to find a $20 bill she lost. When we're trying to talk about anxiety, stress, those kinds of things that limit our options, poverty plays a key role in how that expresses itself, and it plays a key role in the tools we have to try and get out of it. Another story involves a man we're going to call Jim. Jim's a salesman. Mental health. Jim has a disorder called bipolar disorder. And Jim's expression of that disorder includes occasional periods of psychosis where he gets really paranoid and believes the world is literally out to get him. This disorder has cost him a marriage. It's cost him 4 jobs in 5 years. And he lives every single day worried he's going to, in his words, go crazy again and lose his next job. Ironically, he was laid off 2 weeks ago with COVID-19 cuts. The silver lining? We keep going over that he didn't go crazy and lose his job. The world went crazy and that made him lose his job. So, but we're talking about a person who, again, lives with this constant uncertainty. He won't buy a house because what if he loses his job? He saves half his income to try and make sure that when he needs it, because he's going to go crazy in his mind, he has something to fall back on because he can't guarantee he's going to find work again. And these cycles create more and more challenges where the stress of worrying about life makes you more depressed. And the more depressed you get, the harder it is to maintain your work. And when you don't maintain your work, you worry about losing your job. And when you worry about losing your job, you get more depressed and you get this cycle that goes on and on and on. So when we're trying to think about making changes to systems, I was really impressed when our first speaker talked about going upstream, because we absolutely need to provide resources and help people with their mental health challenges. The more funding we can put into mental health, Manitoba has the least number of psychologists per capita of any province in Manitoba, or any province in Canada. I'm not short of work. That's great for me, but it's really bad for Manitobans. So the more we can make changes to provide supports for them, the more we can make changes to change the system and the environment in which they're trying to work and live, the more we can maximize productivity, maximize quality of life, and hopefully help people function to the best of their ability. I think that's the best I can do to try and put a face on it for how the two things interact. I'd be happy to answer any questions when you have them. You're muted.
Thank you, Dr. Ettinger. Thank you to all of our speakers for taking time to present tonight. So now we have time for a few questions. I'm just gonna read some from the side here. This is a question for Molly. Has anyone developed a concrete interdisciplinary strategy to present to government and the public? I think Molly might be muted. Oh, Monica's on it. Okay.
Yeah, thanks for the question. If you're talking about a strategy regarding mental health, well, that is the Virgo report that the government funded that was presented to government with recommendations. It is also, the full title is down here, it is the Improving Access and Coordination of Mental Health and Addiction Services, a Provincial Strategy for All. So our report found that the government is not systemically implementing their own funded report, and that that is a huge challenge. And there is also another report called The View From Here, which some of you might remember, which is a community-based poverty reduction plan for the province of Manitoba, and our office has published that. The most recent one was in 2015, and this has 50 recommendations for what the province can do to reduce poverty in multiple areas and make poverty history's priority areas, including action on mental health, emerge from the View From Here. There have been some things that were implemented, like rent assist, which is a shelter benefit. More money went for people who are renting privately to be able to afford rent, but it's still not enough for people to, there's not enough housing available at that level for people, and so they're really still stuck. So there are multiple reports. I think what we need here is political will, and we need people like you, or you're getting educated, and talk to people you know in your lives and talk to your elected officials and to make sure that this is a continuous priority for government and that they're being held to account to for action on these very important issues.
Thanks, Molly. Does anyone else have any other questions? I don't see any at the side here. We do have a few more minutes for questions if anyone has. Okay, for Molly, any observations about impact of legislation of cannabis? That's from Jim.
That's not my, I would maybe refer that over to the doctor here. I don't have any information on that.
Certainly cannabis is being used. I don't think there's necessarily a connection between cannabis and the poverty scenario. The people who were using cannabis were often using before it was legalized. I don't have tons of people who are suddenly trying cannabis because it became legal. At least in my caseload, they were using it already. They're just less worried about getting arrested for it.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any other questions? I'll give people a couple of seconds here to type one out if they do. Your stories of toxic work environments are familiar. Do you have ideas about how to hold these accountable? From Daryl.
I'm not really sure how to answer that question.
Can I jump in?
Yes.
One of the challenges with toxic work environments is the power imbalance. It's very rarely the person at the top of the system that is going, this is a toxic work environment. It's the people at the bottom who are bearing the brunt of the abuse who are saying that, and they usually don't have the power to hold people accountable. And these things are subtle, often really hard to prove. How do you go to someone and say, this man's been slipping me a date rape drug for several months and I didn't know about it? Like, it doesn't make it less true, but in a court of public opinion, as soon as you get into an adversarial scenario, accountable becomes a really slippery concept. So with the Me Too movement, there is some movement towards accountability, but it's a challenging and really slippery target to try and hit, in my opinion.
I would, if I could, Kate, thank you so much for your story. I really appreciated hearing that. And I mean, good for you for all the work that you've done on your journey. And thanks so much for sharing it. And toxic work environments, that was like one of the things that you faced. I think a really interesting example, and I the Me Too movement has really changed the conversation, and this idea that one woman telling her story creates courage for other women to come out. And I think it's a really positive movement on many levels in our society. Here, the Stella's restaurant, you might remember, a number of accusations came out, and women got together. There were mostly women who experienced really negative experiences in the Not My Stella's, and it actually impacted the bottom line of that restaurant. And then the workers organized and became unionized by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, which is helping implement, you know, there's some structures there, right? Before that, Stella's hardly even had any HR management. And so that was part of the inadequacy. Of course, service industries are notoriously bad in the culture of the workplace and also interacting with customers. So yeah, I think that's one area where we need to keep talking with unions to and connect with people, and our governments need to support unionization efforts as well, because when people are precarious going between jobs, it's really hard to organize that type of workplace as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just read out a comment. Kemlin says, I think across the board, we need to support unions and unionized workplaces and strengthen and support workers' rights. So kind of just echoing what you've just said, Molly, as well.
Thanks, Cameron.
Do we have any other questions? We do have a couple of minutes left. Okay. Well, thank you to all of our speakers for taking the time to present tonight and answer questions. It's been an honor having all three of you share your thoughts and experiences. So thank you for that. It was very moving. Thank you all for attending. We hope this has been informative and has in some small way assisted you to find your place in reducing poverty in Manitoba.